Good morning and welcome. This is The Morning Voice. I am your host, Ted Maxwell, and back after a little over a week off, I want to thank Matt Neely right off the bat, not only for being behind the glass and keeping me on time and on target, as he does every week, but also for sitting in as a guest host last week on the Tuesday morning version of Civic Engagement on The Morning Voice. So, Matt, thank you very much. It was a great show. Love listening to it from Wisconsin, and I really always appreciate all you do to make this show, The Morning Voice, a reality for all five of us, not just for me. But thank you for being my go-to guest host every time I get out of the city.
Thanks, Ted. We had a great time speaking with Jesse Lugo, also with author Ann Hillerman, and we worked your theme, civic engagement, into both discussions, and so it was really good. And then you got Ben coming up next week, Ben Bueller Garcia. So we got that to look forward to. But welcome back, and good to have you back.
Now that will be the last Tuesday I miss, perhaps between now and the end of the year.
I was going to say, perhaps it's like Johnny Carson's schedule this summer.
Well, you know, it's all the big bucks I get for being here. You know, it just works that way. You know, but I really do appreciate Matt. You're the glue that's behind The Morning Voice 5 days a week, 7 to 9, five different hosts. Lydia Rand on Monday with The Rainmakers, where she focuses on the nonprofit sector and those who do things to help this community. You're stuck with me on Tuesdays, where we talk about civic engagement. Grant Kruger, Food for Thought, on Wednesdays. Plenty of politics involved in my conversation as well as his. Tom Moulton on Thursdays with Tom's official job is with the Tucson Attractions, but he talks about all the ongoing events and the things that are exciting to do in the region and in the city of Tucson. And then on Fridays, Ed Ackerley, the brainchild behind The Morning Voice and the previous Jump in Tucson, and he will talk about the rising businesses and successes that have occurred in our region, and then he'll jump into the wonder of the University of Arizona. So Tuesdays, what do we focus on? The purpose of this show is to try to get people engaged. It's to try to get you involved in your community. We're a nation bound by shared values of freedom, liberty, and equality. And with that comes some rights and responsibilities. For many of us, that includes the most sacred right, the right to vote, something we should all do. And you'll hear us stress about that time and time and time again. We've got an election coming up in CD7, and we've got fall in November, we're going to have some ward council races. The second hour, that will be the afternoon, I guess, for this show, but the second hour we'll have Leighton Rockefeller Jr., Democratic candidate for Ward 6.
Voting starts tomorrow.
It's hard to believe.
It's for the primary. It is.
It gets going early.
And we're almost to election day in the CD7 special primary.
So. Right. There's a lot going on for this time of the year. Obviously, the city elections being in the odd numbered years. We knew they were coming. They're heating up. They've kind of been dwarfed a little bit by CD7, but we'll jump in and talk to Leighton about his campaign, what he's finding out. He's a first-time candidate, a longtime city resident, and that's one way to get involved. We've talked a lot. Lydia Randa highlights it. I used to highlight it on Jump In. A lot of nonprofit leadership. That's another way to get involved. You can be involved in your community. There's so many things you can do to make this region, our city, our county, state, a better place to live. And that's kind of our responsibilities with all the freedoms we've got. I always like to remind people there's no better place to live. That's evidenced by how many people try to come to our country all the time because they know this is a land of opportunity. Now, you might not have believed that when you listen to the news feed that Matt gave us as we were coming in, but it leads in perfectly for the conversation we're going to have with our first guest. I really want to thank Tucson Police Department Chief Chad Kazmar for joining us today, and you've shown up earlier than I thought, and so we're going to get a full hour with you, so this is going to be great.
Right on. Here we go. All right. I was panicking for a minute. Matt said, you know, he kicked off the show, and you didn't jump in. I was thinking, well, I guess I'm running the show today. So thanks, Matt, for making sure.
See, the little secret is I had to wait till he gives me the finger, and it's the good finger. It's the finger that he points at me and
it's the index finger, just for clarity.
I was waiting for that. I knew something was going on, but until he says go,
listeners, I can't see that part, so it was induced a little bit of panic. But
there's
we were going to sort it out.
There's no panic with this one.
Yeah,
Chief, you heard the purpose of this show is to try to get people engaged, and you were on Jump In with me before we moved to the drive time hours now. What always amazes me is I always like to have our guests say, tell us how they got involved. But for you, it's pretty straightforward. You graduated from the University of Arizona and you joined the Tucson Police Department.
Yeah, absolutely. I was employed by the city as a lifeguard through college, and best job I ever had, where I met my wife, who would become my wife. And I still say to this day, the best thing the city ever gave me was the opportunity to meet my best friend and my wife, who holds down the fort at home so I can be the chief of police. And she keeps me grounded and focused. And,
so I'm going to have to ask, was she a swimmer or another lifeguard?
Oh, yeah. No, she was another lifeguard. But she was a swimmer through high school. I was a recovering surfer who wasn't a swimmer, but thought, man, that'd be a great job. And it was a great college job. So, yeah, I've been employed by the city for almost nearly 30 years at this point, if I include my lifeguard.
And so did you have the dapper looks? And for those of us, those of the folks that are watching on our stream on Facebook or YouTube, they can see. Did you have those dapper looks in the day when you were a lifeguard as well?
Well, I don't know about that. There was a lot less gray hair there.
It obviously worked. You found your wife, your best friend, and your life's partner. And I want to thank anyone who supports anyone who serves in public service. With the military wives play such a critical role, no different every day.
Absolutely.
To get up and have somebody that you really care about and go out and do what you do as a member of the Tucson Police Department and all your men and women do. You have to have a partner. You have to have a strong support system behind you that not only, as you said, allows you, because I'd say your life's kind of busy right now.
A little bit.
But allows you to go do that. You really do need a grounded person to support that going on.
Absolutely. These are both public safety work and military work can be extremely taxing, and the exposure of some of the things that we'll talk about today and the impact that has on you. And if you don't have somebody to go home to that helps keep you balanced and grounded in conjunction with the mental health investment that we've made over the last few years, it's all really, really important. And my wife's got dual duty because she's a military mom also with our oldest son who's serving in the Army.
Oh, make sure you thank him for us for his service in the Army. And where's he stationed right now?
Buckley Space Force Base. So he's an Army kid living an Air Force life right now as an intelligence officer. So
when I got out of the active duty Air Force, joined the Guard full time, it was either Buckley or Tucson.
Yeah.
I'm very grateful that Tucson called first because it turned into an incredible career. And I love Tucson. I'll never leave. That's one of the things why I care so much about this community as a whole. So that's not a bad place to be if you're serving.
He was happy he didn't get service, and not because we don't love service or friends to the South, but he was looking to travel and get some exposure. So.
Oh, he may get the opportunity to travel yet.
You never know.
Colorado's just a little piece away. He may get, whether he wants to or not, he may get some opportunities.
He's looking to go overseas, so we're excited. But listeners probably know, but 35% of our organization is made up from military veterans, those who have served and continue to serve and have in the National Guard. So we love our military folks.
And trust me, the military loves the support they get from police and fire throughout the regions. So we talked about already people who serve. So manpower is always a big issue inside the city of Tucson.
Yes.
So could you talk a little bit about where you sit right now with your sworn officers, your deployable officers, situations that trouble you, maybe how many of your folks face retirement, and we'll get into the CSOs, the community service officers, after this.
Sounds good. So we have 1,300 total authorized positions. That means commissioned police officers, professional staff team members, which include our community service officers and professional staff investigators. We have 1,222 of those positions filled right now. 770 of those are police officers. And then we have an additional 63 folks that are in different various stages of training to become commissioned officers. Some have graduated from the academy. Some are still in the academy.
So if I did my math real quick, about 130, 140 short, more than that?
We're over the last decade, we've been about 100 shy of what we're authorized. You know, I like to try to tell folks, you know, I've when I first got here as chief almost 3.5, almost on the backside of 4 years ago, the number that I threw out that I really wanted to get the department to quickly was a 900 commissioned and a 300 additional professional staff investigators and community service officers. So we're still about a, you know, 100 shy of where we'd like to be on our commission. And then what we also have to think about is our attrition numbers. So we've slowed attrition down. That's how we've been slowly building the department back up, but we reduced the attrition number, really focusing on retaining the staff that we have. But we sit here today with about 200 officers that are eligible to retire, which is a scary number when we're talking about around a 750 you know, deployable police officers for the 33rd largest city in the country.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but that total number of authorizations is down from what it used to be 10 years
ago. Yeah, in the peak of my career, we had over 1,000 deployable officers. So when we think about a 25-year career that even I've had in a population that was smaller with less crime and less complexities of investigating that crime and holding folks accountable, things have changed and shifted. And so we've had to figure out how to use technology, professional staff employees, and different evidence-based strategies to try to manage and address the crime trends that we have with the number of staff that we have while we work to rebuild the department.
So I'm going to ask you something. The numbers, your goal, 900 plus the professional, and having professional officers now is I think, a good change. I think it kind of reclassifies it, but it also tells more of the story about who's not deployable. Mm-hmm. To the street and your CSOs. In your perfect world, how many deployable officers would you like to have to serve this region?
Yeah, at least 900. I mean, 900 is the benchmark, the goal I'd like to get to where we can then reassess how we're doing. It likely will take more than that, but you know, we want to have achievable goals for you know, city leadership and the community, and I think that's a realistic number that we can get to if we all collaborate, work together. So on that note, join TucsonPD.org. We're always looking for great people. It's been an absolutely meaningful profession for me. I'd love if either one or both of my sons followed my footsteps. So if you know, if your child's sitting at home this summer and they're not sure what they, you know, what they're doing with their lives, I tell you, it's City of Tucson's been a great employer for me. It's provided a great life, and you know, it segues into that community service officer and why it's so important is that we have difficulty. We have not lowered our standards for police officer recruits. We refuse to do that. That's a short-term gain and a long-term problem. And so really looking at that community service officer, I can hire kids graduating from high school or with GEDs that will make more than the median income in Tucson.
And how many CSOs do you have right now?
We have 133 with additional 9 in training right now. And those folks become, not only do they do great work out in the community where they can respond to collisions, they can respond to burglaries overs, you'll see them at community events. They help us with traffic control when we have protests and different community activities. I mean, they're such a valuable team member and an asset. And what they've done is they've reduced our level 4, we'll get into this a little bit later in the show, but reduced our level 4 response times by 40%. So it's just been a great addition to the team and a scaling. What it also does is it helps us farm our own. It's a grow our own program where we get kids in those, you know, vulnerable years where from 18 to 21, they can start making some decisions that impact their life. And then a percentage of those team members then become police officer recruits.
Have we gotten to the point yet where any CSOs have become?
Oh yeah, we have about 5% of our community service officers right now who are jumping into those police officer recruit academies. But I'd like to see that number be quite a bit higher.
Well, there's no doubt. I think it's people want to see somebody from the force show up when they respond.
Correct.
Mean, just little things like traffic accidents, you know, especially when there's some fault involved. It's great that the fire can help,
right,
and they can show up, but ultimately people want to see somebody with a badge who then is also able to fill out a report that someday may be required in court if there's a problem from the accidents.
Yeah, and the community service officers can enforce city code ordinances, and some of those are moving violations related to traffic collisions. So it's been a, like I said, it's been nothing but positive feedback from the community, and when city leadership gives me these positions to fill, I can fill them. I don't struggle to fill those positions. So it's so again, if you're listening this morning, go join TucsonPD.org. You can find out more. You know, I look at it as like a college would farm athletes, right? It's time where we have to really start, you know, going after these kids who aren't really sure if they want to go to college or a trade. And if they're not sure, you know, we hook them up with a great job in the city and try to keep them.
There is something about being part of a team. There's no doubt about that. Before we cut to break, you mentioned you've got over 200 retirement eligible officers.
Right.
What do you think's keeping them on board?
That's a great question. I mean, that's something I focus on every day. We're doing a retirement today of one of our senior lieutenants that'll be leaving the department, where we'll also be honoring their family. We actually have a part of our ceremony is honoring the children and the spouses and the support that they provided to their loved one to be able to do this job. Every retirement is a sad day for me and a happy day for the family. And part of me is I'm extremely happy that they've had a meaningful career and they're going on to their chapter two, but it's a loss for the department. And one thing to think about, you know, we talk about attrition of, let's say, four commissioned officers a month. So, you know, you can have 80 to 200 years of experience that walk out the door. And so in a profession where you go to a police academy for 4 months and an advanced training for another 4 months or another month, it's 5 months, and then an additional 4 months of training, 9 months of total training, if you think about the dynamic job that we ask our police officers to do, doesn't equip you for the full, you know, experiences that you're going to be exposed to. And that's something we have to continue to work on again. So that goes really back to in a world where I'm required to follow Arizona Post standards for training, as is every police department in the state. And it's really a standard that's followed through the country. But the reality is you can't go install a water heater or an air conditioning unit no. until you're apprentice for 3, 4, or 5 years, right? But yet we give these 22-year-old adults, you know, whose brains aren't fully developed, and we give them some really big responsibilities.
There's no doubt about that. And Chief, I'm going to just say it up front. I think leadership inside of an organization and wanting to be part of the team keeps people around, especially in today's day and age where any police officer can retire and get picked up by another organization and essentially be double dipping again. So there's a reason those folks are staying. So and I'm going to give that to you and your team, because I know it's not just that. The chief at the top, it's the rest of the team. They've got to have faith in the leadership that they're under.
Absolutely. An environment, we've worked really hard the last couple of years to build trust and connection within the organization. If we don't have that within the team, we don't see that out in the community.
Absolutely.
We've partnered with a company called Boulder Crest, who really started their line of work, mental health investment. It's a post-traumatic growth foundation.
Great organization.
Fantastic. And we've been really lucky. We're the premier police department they work with in the country. We've scaled about 3/4 of our department. It's been through a full week-long struggle well program where we really give folks the skills and the tools that they need to process life's experiences. And then we throw about 80% more trauma than the average human being gets exposed to on top of them.
Absolutely. So we've got to cut to a break. We're going to have a short segment when we come back. That's the voice of Chief Chad Kazmar of Tucson Police Department. And you are listening to 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. We'll be right back.
Man, we got the mercury blues in Tucson, don't we? Get the back to double-digit temperatures. Hey, if you'd like to follow along on Facebook or YouTube, 1030 The Voice is the channel on either of those platforms, and we're streaming in video there so you can see your voice. Morning Voice will be right back.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell. Matt Neely behind the glass, as always. And our guest this morning is Police Chief Chad Kazmar with the Tucson PD. Chief, we covered a lot in that first segment. And we'll get a little bit more into funding later in the show as well. But one of the things to keep your officers happy in here is to be paid a competitive wage. Is the funding there yet? Do you need, I know the answer is you always need more, but do you really need more in order to get to the point where we can encourage those 200 plus retirees to stay a little bit longer as well as recruit and not, you're competing against Sarita, you're competing against, you're competing against Oro Valley, and you know, yesterday on listening to one of the Ward 6 debates, Leighton Rockefeller pointed out he was on a ride along, and somebody from the county walked over to him and said, "Hey, if you're thinking about coming on to the with the police, you need to look at Sarita; they pay better." I mean, you're fighting that every day.
Yeah, we are. So it's a really difficult thing for me as chief. I mean, I'm one of many directors for the city, so there's finite money. It's one bucket of money that has to be spread throughout all my colleagues.
Yeah, I don't want to get you in trouble, but what do you need?
Yeah, so what I need is I need competitive salaries. We're asking the work. I have a deep respect for our 10 public safety organizations that surround us and that we collaborate with, our sister agencies, including the Sheriff's Department, and some really great leadership in this region, and we work closely together. But the reality is when young adults are looking at starting pay, it's no secret that if they come work for a large city, a major metropolitan city, there's going to be more work, more exposure, more risk, more violence, and they need to be compensated for that. So you talked about it earlier about there's certainly a component of the foundation is a trust and connection with the leadership team that's engaged and is equipping and staffing and providing policy and support that folks need to be successful, team members need to be successful. But an important part of that is also compensation. So we've gained some ground, but we have more ground to gain. So we've, with TPOA, negotiated with the city leadership basically just under 5% package, and the goal is to do that for 3 years in a row. And I've had conversations with the mayor and the manager that we're going to probably have to do a little bit more than that to get us where we need to be. It's market. It's really a market thing. When we look at what happened the last 5 years around the policing profession and the expectations of performance and then the accountability component, there's got to be commensurate pay that goes with that. And so I think when we look and we've had, 100 vacant historical positions, we have to start recognizing that pays has to be adjusted. And there's benefits package, and there's all sorts of different things, retention pay, recruiting, bonuses. There's all these different things that we can do, and we evaluate and we study those throughout the country. We actually did get just under $100,000 this year for the first, which should be an intentional money for recruiting and advertising. So again, you've seen, nothing's more frustrating than when we see Albuquerque PD advertising on our own buses for police officers, and we have to think about that. How do we keep folks local? And I haven't been big on going outside of Tucson or even outside of the state to recruit. I've not seen those yield great returns. And Tucson is uniquely Tucson. And I think when we can hire and recruit from within our community, that it provides a higher level of service and connection to the community.
No, absolutely. And I told you this was going to be a quick session, and it is. But the thing that I think you mentioned that's so important for people to understand, being a police officer in Tucson's got more challenges, more danger, more direct interaction than a lot of the other ones. And the city's got to understand they need to be compensated fairly.
Absolutely.
So with that, we're going to be with Chief Kazmar for another 30 minutes after this. If you're interested in with a question, 520-790-2040. You're listening to 1030, The Voice, trusted local news and talk. We'll be right back. Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. That's Steve Miller Band. I asked Chief when he was coming on who he'd like to lead into. And sometimes you forget just how good the music from the 70s and 80s was when it's got lead-in music. I mean, it's something that Matt can find a perfect segment. We're going to go with a big drum roll or a big, riff. It's something that's going to go. So, Chief, appreciate that. So we're going to transition to some of the issues regarding crime and what's going on. Obviously, you heard the news feed. There's nothing that's in your business, you're not going to get out of it, because things that happen in town are going to be of significance and importance, and they become newsworthy. The news Absolutely. Is always looking to it. So we talked a little bit yesterday about the crime piece of it, and what's from your point of view? You've been with TPD since 2000. How's the crime today and the trend of the crime today, the reality, compared to throughout the rest of your career?
So we certainly are facing more violent crime that involves guns. In a post-COVID world, it just seemed like things changed where young adults and youth, young men specifically, resulted to violence with firearms much faster than we had ever seen before. And in 2021, we peaked. We set a record of nearly 90 homicides that year. And so since then, we've been working really hard, we haven't been shy about talking about our effort to reduce as a city, as a police department, and really being focused on reducing violent crime related to firearms. And your news feed, as you said, the senseless murder of Dadrian Brown over the weekend, 15-year-old young man at a party, and also the ultimate death of Raven, who one of our canines, mm-hmm. who passed away over the weekend, had to be put down related to being shot three times, as again you covered already. And it really just highlights for me of focus. We talked earlier about what keeps me up at night, and gun crime is violent crime related to firearms is certainly one of those things that I continue to be laser focused on. We're sitting at 32 homicides year to date, 27 last year. And so anytime we're higher, we look at crime basically
27 total last year, 27 year to this
date.
Time
year to year date. Okay. So we look at when we're looking at trends, I get crime stats weekly. We're looking at previous year, we're looking at 5 year averages on all of the metrics that we look at. And so right now at part one, and I'll start with saying the data is only good is what the community is reporting. right? And there, because there's a conversation about that. Well, TPD data is not accurate. It probably isn't fully accurate related to some types of crime where community might be frustrated with call response times. Violent crime doesn't tend to be an issue with capturing because folks are calling in. Hospitals were reported if it's not reported by the victim themselves. We obviously collaborate with the fire department on those types of things. So when we look at Part 1 violent crime, right now we're sitting at a reduction of year-to-date of nearly 13% and a five-year reduction of 12%. And when we look at Part 1 property crimes, we're sitting at nearly 29% year-to-date reduction and nearly a 29% reduction on a five-year average. Again, when we looked at homicides, we're five higher today than we were last year. That's something we're going to continue to work on. We also track, which is not typical for all the police departments or even major cities, but we also track non-fatal skin piercing shooting incidents. And so that was something, because what we're talking about is a 16th of an inch or luck or medical care provided by my officers or TFD before we can get somebody to the hospital that saves their lives. But we're sitting at 66 of those incidents, and we had 83 year to date, which is a 20% reduction. So as far as those numbers go, you know, I'm happy. Then we also look at our call response times. We look at how many calls for service that we're running. We've responded to over 74,000 dispatch calls for service from our 911 partners this year. But the other number that's impressive to me is 50. You know, there's this narrative that in my career time, we will not have enough officers, but that's not an excuse for me not to address the crime trends.
Absolutely. You work with what you've got.
We do. And we don't, you know, you don't go to war with army that you want, you go to the one that you have. Right. And I couldn't be more proud. And I, you know, woke up my typical wake up morning, this reading resumes and all the activity that happened last night. And I must've read at least 5 or 6, 10 resumes where we're doing proactive on-site activity, where we know businesses are struggling with plight related to fentanyl and the unsheltered population, and officers are out there doing proactive work. 52,000 on-site activity calls for service and 16,000 traffic contacts. So when we look at our priorities, we're really working to reduce violent crimes, focused on gun crime, narcotics, traffic safety, and our staffing, which means retention and recruiting. And those are our key strategic initiatives that we're focusing on.
So you mentioned the increase in likelihood of gun violence, just societally, it's changed, access. I mean, there's so many things that play into it. You know, we could talk about if it was video games growing up, if it just makes it. But there does tend to be that response. And yes, things they're improving. Obviously, you're five up on the homicides. You don't like that. But that depends how far back we go to compare it. We kind of talked about this. You talked about coming out of COVID. You know, in 2019, there were only 449 homicides for the whole year in Tucson.
Right.
So we're not there yet again.
No.
We came out of COVID. You saw a spike. And a lot of frustrations went into COVID. There's a lot of reasons that could have driven that. But that's where I think the public's concerned when we hear either from you know, the department or from the county prosecutor or, you know, the county attorney that, oh, it's trending in the right way. Well, it's trending from an exceptionally high number.
Sure.
So
that should not be the benchmark.
Agreed. Right. I agree. So you talked the reality of the numbers, but then there's also the drivers and the direction that it's going based on those drivers. What do you see that's driving some of this?
Poverty drives violent crime. And we still have nearly twice the poverty rate of the rest of the country. So until we address that, that is a root cause driver of crime. The second one is our educational systems. If we want to put kids on the right track, kids who live in broken homes or no home, or they're living in a car. I've also been involved on the leadership team of Boys and Girls Club for nearly a decade at this point. We know youth investment, youth engagement, getting our kids a high school education or GED and then helping them get them employed reduces violent crime. Also having an appropriately staffed police department. We know that when we do hot spotting, which is we'll put a police car at a specific location at a specific time for a specific duration, it decreases crime. We have evidence
absolutely
to support that. So it's the perfect storm when you don't have enough police officers and you have 50 kids in a class where the teacher can't fully assess and engage those kids. You have more broken homes. You have parents who are working multiple jobs to pay their bills or living in a car. All those are contributors to the environment that we're living in. And what I like to tell people is, you know, when systems fail, all other systems fail, the 911 system gets engaged. right? When somebody's in mental health crisis, if somebody's is resorted to, you know, they have substance use disorders, you know, what I try to tell folks with, you know, as somebody with lived experiences who lost my own uncle to heroin use in our own community while I've been employed at this police department, my little brother's recovering opiate addict, my family is a consumer of services in our community. What I will tell you is, think about the complexity of the problem that we're charging local government with to solve, you know, the unsheltered population or the homeless issue, when their original wraparound service, the family, has given up on that individual.
There's one, that's a great point and discussion point, because the family is the core to a lot of support for the young next generation. And the rest that you had on Saturday night when Sunday night when your CRT pulled over a car and you had a 14-year-old that had a weapon in his waistband. I mean,
it's not unusual anymore.
Yeah.
And again, not only did I read a bunch of narcotics resumes, but I read, we probably pulled 5 guns off of the street just last night. Just in the resumes that I read last night.
Yeah, that's something that needs to be addressed. So I do want to go to a caller. Roberta called in, and she I'll let her tell her story and ask her question. And this relates to the ability to focus on, with the force structure you've got right now, to focus on those violent crimes and then everything else. So, Roberta, thank you for listening to the show this morning, and thank you for calling on. You're on with Chief Kazmar.
Thank you. I enjoy your show. Chief, I empathize with you, and I'm experiencing your lack of officers. I was around on the 4th of July, of course, yeah, and I still haven't had anyone call me back to take my report, and nobody asked me their names or their phone numbers or anything. We have a legitimate phone number because we checked it out, and I would think the police would check out something like that and try catch them and try to stop them before they rob somebody else.
Well, thanks for calling in, Roberta. I missed the front end of what you were reporting.
She was reporting she was robbed on July 4th. I believe she was moving.
She was moving and robbed of her wallet. And she was just trying to talk about how, you know, she can empathize, and well, she. The staffing issue is what she wanted to talk about.
Yep. Sure.
It is that question, as you talked about underreporting, and we've heard from a lot of people, they've just stopped calling. We can't do that. We have to get the numbers to report, because that's the only way you're going to have advocacy. But I guess her question is, she hasn't heard back from anybody.
Sure.
Yet.
So we've got your phone number, and we'll connect offline here. It's not unusual. That what that sounds like is maybe a call of theft that went to a callback, what we call a callback if it was a non-priority call, especially on a night like 4th of July where we're inundated with shots fired calls and fireworks calls and fire issues. And, you know, there's a lot of fear. Obviously, it was good. We got a little bit of rain. But as Matt said, I don't know where the storms are. They haven't been here. But coming back to, I'm always looking to improve service delivery. And I apologize that you haven't had a callback just quite yet. But we'll make sure that happens. We try to we look at our calls for service on our priority levels. We look at level one, which would be somebody's breaking into your house while you're there. A level two, you go home and you've been burglarized and you haven't gone in your house yet to make sure that nobody's inside. And then a level three and a level four. And a theft would, you know, if it was over, could be a level four. And then that gets shipped back to a callback, which is somebody that's on light duty or somebody would take that report from a police station. So we'll make sure we follow up and we get you some service.
Well, I reported it on my landline, which is different from where I'm calling you. But you can reach me on either phone.
We have your. I can see your. We've got your cell phone here, and I'll make sure you get followed up on today.
Okay. I just have to tell you, being a disabled senior, I'm following the police officers. I'm moving where they're going, and I urge the city to do whatever is necessary to help you to get the police officers and the help that you need to do it.
Well, we appreciate your support, and we're definitely working to increase the, you know, in a perfect world, I wish I had twice the amount of police officers that I have, and maybe one day we'll get there.
And Roberta, thank you for listening. We appreciate it. And I also encourage you to continue to voice your concerns and don't hesitate to call TPD when you need them. We know they'll be there for us. So thank you. All right. So Chief, we're going to go to a break now. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about those drivers. I do want to talk about the fentanyl and the impact that's making and the challenge it is for you. And we may get into a little funding. An hour just flies.
All right.
I was glad you showed up early, and I really am glad you showed up early because we've still got so many things that we wanted to cover. We won't get there today. But that's the voice of Chief Chad Kazmar, the chief of the Tucson Police Department. And you're listening to 1030 The Voice. We'll be right back after a short break. Good morning and welcome back. You're listening to their Morning Voice. And Chief, we may just have to roll Steve Miller throughout the entire show. Just because it's really... It's sometimes amazing. Now I'm going to have to start going to all the record shops and find a couple old Steve Miller albums and get them back and put them back on the turntable.
So. Reminds me of my youth.
Yeah.
Oh, there's summer vacations with my dad.
There's a lot. Your youth, and you're a lot younger than me. And I'm going, that's Steve Miller's even farther back. It's your dad that introduced you to him.
We had one cassette tape. Your listeners probably know what that is. Some folks might not, but one tape of, I think 96.1 KLPX that would just, we'd flip and they had just classic rock. So there's some songs that are etched into my memory from my childhood.
That's outstanding.
Yep.
So a couple things that, thank you for your time today. We've got about 5 minutes left, maybe a little less than that short. So I want to get to some of those drivers. We're going to have you come back to talk about the funding.
Sure.
Okay. And the impact of 414, but talked about the drivers that are leading to this. So obviously, homelessness, fentanyl.
We talked about economic drivers or poverty, but fentanyl is the biggest driver of the crisis that we're facing, a public health crisis related to poly drug use of fentanyl and methamphetamine. And so, you know, I've been dealing with, you know, methamphetamine my entire career, but fentanyl has been a game changer. Fentanyl is 100 times stronger than morphine or an oxycodone. So think about that for a minute. Most of us have had a surgery where you're required to be on some type of pain pill. Fentanyl is 100 times stronger than that pain pill you're taking. Now, here's a really scary thing. We've also found carfentanil in our community. And carfentanil is 10,000 times more potent than morphine or oxycodone and 100 times stronger than fentanyl.
So I got a quick question on the carfentanil because we've heard about that more. When you find a pill that's 10,000 times stronger than, is it dosed for a single pill still, or is it something they have to
So it depends on what stage we find it in. It can be a powder form where it's raw and it's being brought here to create more product, or a carfentanil test within a certain pill that we find. And they're we call them M30s.
So blue pills. So the drug scene's not getting any better. It's getting worse. If you were king for a day, what would be your number one recommendation on how to stop this?
Well, it's complicated. You have to look at it multifaceted. We have to stop the precursor drugs from going from China to Mexico. We obviously have to keep it going, from Mexico to the United States. 50% of the fentanyl in this country is seized in the state of Arizona. Think about that for a minute. 50% of the fentanyl seized in our country is seized in our state. So our proximity to the border makes it super accessible and affordable. It also goes into accountability. So when we get to be the face of a complete system, but decision making at our courts, both our misdemeanor courts and our felony courts, and the judge decisions and how we invest in treatment services for these folks are all inclusive in how we address this crisis.
So is there a policy coming out of the county attorney's office that has established when there's going to be charges and when there's not, just for somebody who has them not dealing, just somebody who's got pills on them or are under the use of the narcotics? Is there any official policy?
I'd say it's more of a practice and a policy of less than 10 pills is likely to not be issued if we have an arrest, if there's no underlying additional charges, which is problematic because those folks are not then receiving treatment.
Well, and if people know that that's the number out there, they're never going to get caught carrying anything more than that.
Correct. So we've made over 11,000 arrests this year, both between felony and misdemeanors. And I'll tell you, our felony arrests are up 17% year-to-date, 8.2% for our five-year average. And we look at our narcotics arrest, our felony arrests are up almost 48% year-to-date and 43% over a five-year average. When we talk about felonies and we talk about misdemeanors, we're up 18% on our misdemeanor arrests for narcotics and 94% over a five-year average. So what that tells you, Ted, is the officers are out there doing the work, and we're doing our part, but now we need other parts of the system to increase their
work. Any idea on how many of those, what the percentage of arrests that actually get charged? We've only got about 15 seconds.
The average over the last decade is about 50% of those.
50% actually get
correct.
Get charged. Not necessarily go to court, but get charged.
Correct.
So, Chief Kent, thank you enough for joining us today. I'd like to bring you back on a more regular basis just to do this. So be careful I will take you up on that.
And I appreciate everybody listening this morning.
All right, that's Chief Kazmar, Tucson Police Department. Greatly appreciate your service, your family service, and make sure you give your wife our thank you as well.
Thank you, sir.
All right, you're listening to The Morning Voice on 1030, The Voice, trusted local news and talk. We'll be back at the top of the hour.
Have a great day, Tucson.
Good morning and welcome back. You are listening to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell. Matt Neely behind the glass, keeping us on time and on target. I want to thank Chief Chad Kazmar for joining us for a full hour this morning to talk about the Tucson Police Department and the challenges that they face, both from a manning, a funding, and from a crime standpoint. So it was a great conversation with the chief. Hopefully you're watching either on Facebook Live or on YouTube. And if not, go to kvoi.com if you missed that interview later today, and you can download the podcast and hear everything that Chief had to say. But I'm very honored at this time to be joined by Danielle Alvarez, the Republican National Committee, one of the Republican National Committee's senior advisors. Ms. Alvarez, thank you for joining us today.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you, and I'm going to purpose of this show in a large part is to try to get people engaged, involved. So I know you've only got one segment with us, but I'd love to hear what got you into public policy advocacy and public relations and being communication director. You've worked on Governor Rick Scott's team when he was the governor, and you've worked with President Trump on his campaigns. What motivated you to get involved in this game or this swirly as a profession?
Oh, gosh. Well, first of all, what an honor to be on air with you and your listeners. You know, I wish I could say it was my grand plan. It wasn't. You know, I attribute everything in my life as God putting me in the right place at the right time. My family, I'm originally born and raised in Miami, Florida, but I was born to Cuban immigrants. And my mom unfortunately had to leave Cuba as a result of Fidel Castro's communist regime. And so while we didn't talk politics openly growing up, I always heard the stories about my mom's older sister having to flee the country by herself when she was, you know, just a teenager. And then, you know, them having to pull visas and being able to come, you know, go to Mexico before they came to the United States, ultimately ending up in the greatest country on the face of the earth. And, you know, always heard those stories. So in college, when I got the chance to join my local Republican club and get involved, I got bit by the bug, and I learned that I could help the most people. I can meet really great people. So for any of your listeners, I encourage anybody who has, whether it's a spare dollar to contribute or some spare time to get involved, go to GOP.com, check it out, GOP.com, sign up to get involved, sign up for your local county party, you know, sign up for your state party, volunteer, get involved, because you'll meet some really great people and you'll really be able to make a difference. I mean, we learned that. I was fortunate enough to be a senior advisor on the president's campaign, and the only reason that the president won is because of the power of the MAGA movement and every single person who got involved and fought for our nation alongside him.
Well, I appreciate you making that pitch. That's what this show's about, is getting people engaged, getting involved, find out what they want. And if there's so many different opportunities inside the political spectrum and the opportunity to get involved with a party and make a difference in the direction that our region, our state, and our national government is headed. And you've been very busy lately. What do you think the key things right now that are going on? We just had the big, beautiful bill. There's the tariffs have started, negotiations have begun again. What do you think the key talking points for the Republican currently elected officials and targeting the next 2026 election?
The biggest thing I can say, and if I'm being very candid, you know, I'm really blessed to have had great bosses. I mean, you mentioned off the top, I got to work for Rick Scott, now senator, then governor. And I used to think I was tired then in my 20s. And I'm like, man, I can never sleep. Like, this guy doesn't sleep. And I'm 20 years old and I'm having a hard time keeping up. And then I worked for President Donald J. Trump. And that man really doesn't sleep. That man wakes up thinking about what's best for our nation. I mean, talk about someone who doesn't have to be doing what he's doing, but he wakes up and he pours everything he has into this country. And the one thing I can say is that he goes 100 miles an hour and everyone else has to keep up. So there's not one thing that he's tackling. He's making sure to negotiate and secure a ceasefire between Israel and Iran. He's making sure to negotiate peace between Russia and Ukraine. He is making sure that we are bringing hostages home. He's making sure that the big, beautiful bill passed. He's working the phone, calling members of Congress, making sure that we can have permanent border security, making sure that we can make the Trump's tax cuts permanent. I mean, he's pulling the tariff levers. He is relentless. He is the best fighter I know. I mean, I can't express enough. I mean, a woman shouldn't talk about her age. I'm 36 years old. I used to travel with him on the campaign trail, and I'd be exhausted, and he was still going after an 18-hour day. That is the fight that President Trump brings as he leads the White House in this administration on behalf of the American people.
Well, there's no doubt we need folks back in Washington, D.C. that are going to fight the fight and carry the message. The big, beautiful bill passed. It got a lot of attention here in Tucson, a lot of attention because Congressman Juan Soscomani has been a longtime supporter, and he's in a district that's only a plus 2R. So what is your perspective on the challenges he might face in the coming election next year?
You know, the first thing that I can say, and I tell all candidates this, because one of the great things about the RNC, the Republican National Committee, is we're very much grassroots up to the central party. And obviously, we're very fortunate at the RNC because last cycle, we brought home majorities in the House, we brought home majorities in the Senate, and we won the White House. And in spectacular fashion, by the way. I always repeat this because I think it's so important that we are reminded of the mandate that the American people gave us. 13 battleground states, we won the popular vote, we made gains with Hispanic communities, minority communities, I mean, every type of demographic we made gains with. And again, I go back to, that's the power of grassroots, that's the power of every single American getting involved. The great thing, and I've had the great fortune of meeting Congressman Soscomani, and I tell all candidates this, is you have to be authentically you. That is, first of all, what President Trump's bread and butter is and why I think that his choice as VP was so spectacular, because J.D. Vance, our vice president, didn't try to be Donald Trump. He was J.D. Vance, and it was authentic, and it sunk through. So I think, you know, Congressman Soscomani is such a great candidate for his district because he truly represents that district. The second point that I'll make as we head into the midterms, and I tell anybody who will listen, is that good governance is going to be how we maintain these critical seats, this plus two seat, and how we maintain majorities in all the battleground seats across the country. It's going to be good governance. So when you're seeing these wins and you're seeing that the Economic Council of Advisors has predicted that the big, beautiful bill will bring in $4 trillion in economic revenue. When we see that the CBO says that the president pulling the tariff levers is going to bring in trillions of dollars of economic growth and of revenue to our nation. When we see, especially in Arizona, right, making sure that with the executive orders, we were able to shut down the border. We saw Tom Homan's post on X where he said we had zero illegal aliens released into the interior of our nation. We had 6,000 apprehensions at the border. I mean, you're talking about great success just from the president's executive order on the day he put his hand on the Bible and was sworn in to office. Since then, we've passed the big, beautiful bill. We're going to make border security permanent. So having these wins for the American people and the good work that our members are doing in the House and Senate is how we're going to maintain those majorities, because we're going to be able to tell the American people you have more money in your pocket. That was a campaign promise. We secured the border. That was a campaign promise. We talked about peace through strength. That was a campaign promise. I mean, all of that is a big win for the American people, and that good governance is going to lead to hopefully maintaining, but really I'm hoping we expand our majorities.
And having the trifecta in Washington, D.C. is critical to get things done and to move things from what sometimes appears to be a logjam back in D.C. What was the role of the RNC in ensuring that the Republicans have a chance to keep those majorities?
Well, first of all, let's talk about what happens if we don't have majorities. We've seen how embarrassing the Democrat Party is. All they do is oppose, oppose, oppose. And by the way, it's on really basic things. Secure the border. I mean, that's not even an 80-20 issue. The entire country, I'd say the 90-plus percent, agree with protecting our homeland, with securing our border, with making sure that deadly fentanyl doesn't pour in, with supporting our incredible ICE and law enforcement officers, right? Taxes. You had every single Democrat in the House and in the Senate vote to increase taxes on the American people. Can you believe that? When you have a split chamber, just look at what Democrats are doing now. Oppose, oppose, oppose. They have no message. They have nothing that they're fighting for other than opposing President Trump and opposing this agenda that, again, I reminded all of your listeners, 13 battleground states, the popular vote, making gains with every single demographic, making gains in, I believe it was every single county across the country, right? And that's their game plan. So if they took back the House, you'd see impeachment trials again. We would get nothing done. We would be in gridlock. That is why making sure that we deliver wins for the American people is so important. So what's the RNC's role in this? We are the president's election machine. We work hand in hand with our sister committees. Our sister committees is the National Senatorial Committee and the National Congressional Committee and our SC Senatorial Committee and our CC Congressional Committee. And we all work hand in hand with these midterm elections. We'll take a look at what are our critical battleground seats in Congress, what are our critical battleground states for the Senate. And our job is twofold. And we are so thankful. President Trump, I mean, he's great at hiring. He picked Chairman Whatley, put his full force behind Chairman Michael Whatley. We have Chairman Michael Whatley as the head of the RNC. His job is to raise the money so that then we can invest in programs to turn out the vote and protect the vote. But the biggest thing that I can say is all of this happens through volunteer power. So everyone listening, doesn't matter your age, doesn't matter your ability, if you can get involved, if you have time to spare, please check out GOP.com, sign up for the volunteer programs. There are some folks who like to make phone calls and help, you know, mobilize voters, whether it's voter registration, whether it's mobilizing voters, making sure that voters have their absentee ballots, making sure that they have a plan to vote. Or we have a lot of voters, obviously, since the 2020 election, that really want to make sure to get their eyes on the ballot cast and ballot counting process. And that's what we call at the RNC, protecting the vote. You've heard the president talk about it time and time again. He wants to make sure that this election's too big to rig. Too big to rig means turning out to vote and protecting the vote. And so we have programs, we have volunteer attorneys, but you don't have to be an attorney, where you can watch that ballot count process to make sure that everything is being done according to the letter of the law. That's what the RNC really focuses on. We do that, of course, in tandem with our great President Trump and with the great members of the House and Senate and our sister committees. And again, encourage everyone to get involved. That's the only way that we can maintain and expand these majorities.
And Danielle, I want to thank you for joining us today. I think you've made the case for people to get out, get engaged, and get involved. I also want to thank you for sharing the story of your family. You mentioning Fidel Castro threw me back to Squadron Officer School when I gave a presentation on Castro and his leadership and what he was really trying to do. And more importantly, I also want to thank you for being a military wife. That's a role people don't quite understand, the importance of the military wife to the members that are serving. So thank you for all you're doing within the RNC. We may reach out and contact you again, and I appreciate you taking the time to join us this morning.
I'd be happy to be on anytime. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. That's Danielle Alvarez, one of the senior advisors at the Republican National Committee. Thanks again, and we're going to go to a break. This is 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. When we return, we will have Leighton Rockefeller Jr. on with us, a candidate for the City of Tucson Council, Ward 6.
And if you're listening on radio, if you'd like to see your voice, follow along on Facebook or YouTube. 1030 The Voice is the name of both of those channels, is the name of those channels on both of those platforms. And we're streaming in video there if you'd like to watch and see your voice, even in the summertime in Tucson.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm Ted Maxwell, your host, Matt Neely. You just found a Steve Miller Band song that I may not be aware of.
Somebody give me a cheeseburger, as they say in the song.
There you go. It's there. So we've had a very busy show already today, talking with Chief Kazmar, then Danielle Alvarez with the RNC, and now I'm joined by Leighton Rockefeller Jr.
Make sure
I get the junior on that.
Absolutely.
Leighton is a longtime Tucsonan, born and raised here, and now he's decided to step into the world of politics. And Leighton's running as a Democrat candidate for Ward 6. For those of you who don't know Ward 6, that's the ward being represented currently by Karen Ulick. Before then was longtime Steve Kasacek, and is kind of the way. And it runs kind of long across the city, but it includes downtown and then all the way out to
Wilmot. Yeah.
So it covers the broad spectrum of the city.
Yeah, Stone to Wilmot and roughly Grant to 22nd, 29th.
That's a pretty significant region.
Actually, the smallest by land.
Smallest by land.
But very dense.
Yeah, very dense, yes. And not necessarily the one that's got the greatest impact on the economy. Not
likely.
And the one that's always discussed quite a bit on other issues. So, Leighton, thank you for joining us today. I appreciate you coming on. Can you give us your background? I mentioned that you're a longtime Tucsonan. Kind of talk about why you grew up, and then you can take that right into why did you decide to run for public office?
Yeah, thank you, Ted. It's an honor to be here. This is my first experience on a radio show, so I apologize if it takes me a while to get going here. But yeah, born and raised here in Tucson. I'm a South Point Catholic grad. Went on to Arizona State for undergrad. Met my wife there, so hold the booze. It was a great experience for me. Went on to work for Ford Motor Company. They recruited me out of college to work in a new program where they were bringing in college-educated minorities to work in their dealerships. The ultimate goal was to sell me a dealership, and I would then operate it in a smaller market. Loved that experience. I was in Rochester, New York for 3 years.
So did you actually buy the dealership? So
I did not. Okay. Nope, I didn't. I made it through 3 of the 5 years and decided I had to get myself back to Tucson. This city was calling to me. Not to say anything bad about Rochester, New York. It just is not the desert. It's not the mountains. It's not the culture, the family, the community. So I enrolled in law school, came back to U of A Law in 2008 and graduated in 2011, have been working as a personal injury attorney alongside my father, who has had his practice here since the early 80s. So he's pretty well known, at least in that community, and
I can't tell you how many people, when I've mentioned your name, they said, "Oh, well, he's running for office."
Yeah.
And then when I
he's kind of old,
sure,
right?
Exactly. Then I add the junior. Oh,
yeah.
Oh,
yeah. It's I get that a lot too. For the most part, it's a good thing. Most people like him, so I just go with it. I don't know if I've met anyone who has anything bad to say about him, but it's been a. Jumping into politics in this time has been very rewarding for me. This is my very first run for office, to be perfectly honest with you, Ted. I was not even very deeply involved in sort of, I guess, the Democratic Party or any other aspect of politics prior to this decision. Aside from being a loyal voter and, you know,
that's always paying attention.
Number one
thing we tell everybody they've got to engage on at the minimum is that's a sacred right. Exercise it.
Right.
So I'm going to ask the question then. Why and why now?
So first of all, Steve Kozacik, who I respect very dearly, he I would have never even considered running against him. I think he is a unique politician who truly doesn't really give a darn about so many aspects of what it means to be in politics. He truly is someone that is trying to work for the people and make decisions that he and the people feel are best for them. So when he resigned, that is the first time I even considered this. That was back in May. As he was gone, and I just sort of started paying a little more attention to the way the city hall was functioning, and I didn't really like what I was seeing. I've noticed a path that our city is moving along, which I am not very fond of. I think we have lost focus on many aspects of what it means to run a good city, a city that does well for its residents. And maybe I'm overly optimistic, but I believe that I have some good ideas that we can throw in the mix and try to get us back on the right track. Ultimately, for my children, I don't see them as having many opportunities here in the future to live and work, and I don't like that.
Well, that opens the door wide open for our continued conversation, because I want to dig a little deeper on that. I obviously sent you a list of about 8-9 different issues, but when we come back, I'm going to ask you what you believe are the important things that the municipalities or a municipality should do, in this case specifically the city of Tucson, that they're currently not doing that's got you now engaged and right up front. Thank you for being willing to step into the arena called politics.
Absolutely.
All right. That's the voice of Leighton Rockefeller Jr., candidate for Ward 6 in the city of Tucson.
I'd like to follow along on Facebook or YouTube. 10:30 The Voice is the channel. The Morning Voice will be right back.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell. Matt Neely's keeping me, as always, on time, on target. So appreciate it, Matt. Leighton Rockefeller Jr., candidate for Ward 6, Tucson City Council, is with us today, and looks like we might be getting a phone call. You never know. This could be an interesting time. I want to go back on something you mentioned at the end, that part of what you're doing it for is your kids. So
yeah.
How many kids? How old are they?
Two boys, 6 and 10.
Okay.
They're a lot of fun, a lot of work. They're in Michigan right now with their mother, where she grew up, and it's been great. It's given me a lot of time to just be knocking on doors as often as I can the last week. So
it's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work. And Ted, I am amazed at how rewarding it is. I am surprised by how much I'm enjoying it. I am honored that I've been able to meet so many interesting and compassionate and intelligent people in our community. And, you know, all I have to say is I'm running for office and the door is open, and I have been, that's how I met you, for example. So I have been relishing in the opportunity to meet the best and the brightest and just the everyday folks of Tucson. And it's been really incredible.
So as you have prepared for this, I mean, to me, one of the most important things is, what do you believe the priorities should be for a municipality, and in this case specifically the city of Tucson, i.e. what's the role of the city council member, and maybe even address some of the issues that sometimes our councils take on that they really have no business taking on?
Well, I mean, the role is to make a city function so that the people that live in it can enjoy the city, enjoy their lives, and thrive. And by function, I simply mean, the core of it, the courts, the police, the fire, the utilities, the parks, the streets, all of the bits and pieces of a city that the residents really just expect to work so that they can rely on them and use them and not have to worry that they will be broken or cause them hassle, so that they can focus on raising their family or making their making ends meet with their job or jobs. So, you know, at the core of it, that's what it's all about. And when you get into times of budget shortfalls, like we are now and like we appear to be forecasting for the next few years, those items become even more important.
So you mentioned what I'd call the core competencies. It's a lot of the issues you brought up were and are defined in the charter of the city, of what they're responsible to. You said you decided to run because you didn't like the direction the decision-making process was going and what was happening. What specifically in that area do you see the council needing to change?
I think there has been a loss of focus on driving our economy to provide the jobs and the wages that our residents need to thrive. I'm going to use that word a lot, I think, but for me, that's what we should be focusing on. The Democratic Party in particular, I believe, has been a little lost in the weeds of social justice. Not that I am downplaying the importance of that item. It's just that we've forgotten about economic justice, which is how you actually allow somebody to have the pride, the income, the sense of being in our society that allows them to live a comfortable and happy and prosperous life. So
you're talking about increasing economic opportunities inside the city of Tucson.
Yes.
What do you see the role of the city council, or what do you believe the council can do to help encourage that economic development, if you want to call it that, or the economic opportunities for its citizens? Because we do. We've got one of the highest poverty rates in this half of the United States. Chief Casmar said that's a lot of the problems they're running into on earlier in the show because of the poverty in the region. Yet, I don't see a lot of direct things to address the poverty issue, other than maybe trying to support those that are in need. And I would not sit here and tell you we don't need to support those people in need. But the best way in my mind to support them is to give them the opportunity, the jobs, the living wage, the ability to lift themselves up and make their lives even better.
I agree. And you also, by increasing economic activity, and I'm not necessarily talking about population growth. I mean, we have a lot of room to move just within our current population because of that poverty. You increase revenues to the city. That gives you a larger general fund in which to support those people that need that support. And in the right now, it's a bit of a downward spiral where your lack of focus on economic growth is both decreasing your revenue to the city, as well as increasing the amount of residents that are needing assistance from that general fund. So I think that for me, Tucson is one of my favorite aspects of this city is the incredible diversity and just the wonderful small businesses. When I have friends in town or family, I love taking them around to, you know, all the unique restaurants, the unique the parks, the museums. We have so many small businesses here that are really thriving. So I think that the number one thing that a city council can do is meet with these business owners and figure out what needs to be done to improve their lives. Let's look at my business. I'm part owner of our law firm. It's a very small business, just two lawyers and two staff. But we support a local business that keeps our technology running smoothly. We support the people that do our process serving. We support the people that maintain our building. And it's not hard to see how suddenly this one tiny business of four employees, the network grows and we are supporting, not entirely, but a part of so many other businesses. And I hear a lot of small business owners telling me that they get frustrated by the inefficiencies of permitting, by the slowness that happens down at city when they want to build a new building or expand. And a lot of them have told me they simply choose to expand into unincorporated Pima County in order to avoid those headaches, in order to be up and running, you know, in half the time. And that's just a travesty for the city.
So what I heard you say is, let's expand the revenue, not the rate.
Yes.
Okay, so there's a lot to be said. A lot of municipalities' budgets have grown significantly. So I'm not going to knock the city of Tucson for now having a $2.4 billion budget. A lot of people could. I'm not going to, because most of the cities in the state budget even grew a lot in the last 5 to 10 years. The difference is a lot of people grew based on increasing revenues in their city, not increasing tax rates. And that's kind of what I heard you lean in on.
Yes.
What role do you think the city of Tucson can do that? I'm not going to ask you if you're business friendly, because the answer to from every politician is, are you business friendly? Yes. But you alluded to some of the things. What could you else do you think that you can do inside the city to make it easier for businesses to succeed? You mentioned permitting.
Yes.
Public safety?
Public safety is a huge one. We have reached a point in our city where many businesses are having to hire private security. We have this new ARS that was passed by the voters last year that potentially it gives businesses the ability to sue the city and get some tax revenues back for mitigation costs of the homeless, graffiti, nuisance laws that are being violated. So all of these issues are going to continue to come to a head with the city. And the fact of the matter is, businesses are closing. Businesses are moving out of the city, taking their tax revenue with them. Businesses are suffering with revenue, because they are customers are not feeling safe to go in there. Go into any store these days, and more than half of the merchandise is behind locks, and that makes it harder to sell. So all of these items are just like in the general bucket of public safety, which is something that I feel needs to be thoroughly examined, and we need to be paying our police officers better wages so that we can keep them and attract new talent to that force.
So before we go to the break, in the line of discussion we've got right now at the League of Women Voters, I won't call it a debate, but at their forum,
yes,
you had one of the unique answers on Project Blue. So can you explain what your position right now on Project Blue is, and how, obviously you won't have to address it because it will be decided before you're elected, if you should be elected. But what is your thought behind the current debate on Project Blue?
I think I am as frustrated as many about the lack of details. I understand this is apparently how things are done in that world, but when it comes to environmental issues like power and water, I think at least the people making our decisions, that being the county and the city, deserve to know the details. I've read the proposals. I've read the fact sheets. And a lot of the promises made come off sounding really incredible. I think there's a tremendous opportunity here. I think there is a lot of lack of trust in our public right now, and that's what I'm hearing when I knock on doors, that nobody believes any of these promises are achievable or even that they're intended, that they believe that these are just things that look good on paper so that we will sign off and then give free rein to this massive project. I'm trying to look at it a little more nuanced than that, because I do see this as a tremendous opportunity, But I want to be speaking with those people who are responsible for making those promises a reality, like Tucson Water with the 18 miles of purple pipe, like TEP, who I know currently is pretty maxed out on power supply and demand. So I want to know how these promises are going to be kept, because if they are, in fact, attainable and achievable, we have the potential to, create a sustainable data center in the desert that, in theory, can attract a lot more future development that is sustainably focused, which is exactly what Tucson as a city should be seeking.
Yeah, I thought you did a good job at that debate outlining that it's an opportunity to set the standard for how you do this in an environment like Tucson, like the desert, and do it sustainably. What's your concerns if the city says no?
Like I said at the forum, another closed for business sign. It's going to be many, many years before we have another opportunity. And I want to be clear, I'm not saying this is the best project, perfect project. I don't even know it once I find these details how I would vote. But that is a big fear of mine, that we would be just signaling to the business community abroad that we are not interested in your developments or your investments.
And that's the voice of Leighton Rockefeller Jr., Democratic candidate for Ward 6 on the Tucson City Council. And we will be back with him in just a moment. You're listening to 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. My guest is Leighton Rockefeller Jr., candidate for Ward 6 on the Democrat side. So you do have a primary. I know at the League of Women Voters, Jake Talkoff, the only Republican running in Ward 6, was happy to tell everybody he's going to be on the ballot.
Yes.
But you've got to get through a primary.
Yeah. Is Steve Miller always the opening
No,
music?
This Chief Kazmar picked Steve Miller today.
Today was Steve Miller Tuesday.
It's great.
So I could have reached out and said, hey, Leighton, what do you want to listen to? But we started rolling on Steve Miller early today and just kept it going. So that's perfect. Glad to hear that. So let's talk real quick about some of the things you've addressed. One, you talked about raising the revenues for the city. That's the target. Economic, driven and go. Not always relying on raising the rate, because everybody pays the rate. Doesn't matter,
The
tax rate. Yeah. If you're raising your revenues through taxation, particularly sales tax, it's regressive, it hurts the city, it does that. What was your position on Prop 414, which was an effort to raise a half-cent sales tax?
Yeah, I was the only Ward 6 candidate to publicly come out against it. It was, and as we later found out, that was a very popular opinion, as it lost by, I think, 70% against. So that proposal was uniquely crafted to anger residents from both sides of the political spectrum. And I think that's difficult to do, but it did it well. And I thought it was just an over expansion of government without any plan on how to pay for the maintenance, the personnel costs after the tax expired. It seemed a bit crazy to me. And ultimately, what disappointed me the most was mayor and council's reaction when it failed, which was basically, well, this was what we needed. You guys voted the wrong way, so you figure it out. And that was her on her Instagram and some of her official channels. I just very much was disheartened by that response, because when you are an elected official, you are working for the people. This isn't personal. This is you crafted a proposition that it was not popular. And whether you want to blame outside forces, which I disagree with, or just simply that your polling was off and you misread the room, whatever you want to blame, fine. But don't just say, oh, well, you guys deal with it. Because what you need to be doing is figuring out what was so unpopular about that piece and how to make it work. Because if you indeed want to be raising taxes, you got to make sure you're doing it right. And again, I don't think that you should be raising taxes to begin with, but I think the reaction to that loss was telling.
Well, there's no doubt the argument against was just that. The tax rate in the city of Tucson would have become the highest tax rate in the state.
For large cities, yeah.
For at over, yeah, yeah. Over 75,000.
Right.
Exceeding Glendale. And Glendale's tax rate's so high because of one thing, the stadium.
Right.
So, Leighton, we have barely been able to scratch the surface today.
It's been fun.
So a couple weeks out from now, I may ask you to come back and give us an update on your campaign and how things are going.
That'd be great.
I appreciate all the time you spent with Stan. Best of luck in throughout the race. I encourage our listeners to stay on to listen to Kathleen Wynn on Wynn Tucson, and absolutely tune in tomorrow morning with Grant Kruger on the Morning Voice Food for Thoughts.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Leighton. Appreciate you joining me today. And everybody, have a great week and keep tuning in.